Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Labor Day is dedicated to the achievements of American workers. But unlike most holidays, it's a nebulous celebration without shared rituals, except for maybe camping or a family barbecue. For many of us growing up, it simply meant summer was coming to an end. But Labor Day exists because workers demanded structural change to the world of work. To understand the foundations of Labor Day, we reached out to historian Matt Peel, a former Augustana University professor who now teaches at Texas Tech.
Dr. Peel, welcome and thank you for spending time with us today. Let's start looking at some of the history of Labor Day, because it seems like these days people know that there might be a sale,
right?
And maybe you shouldn't wear white after Labor Day. And right. I hope that you'll tell me that I can at some point, but it's so much more than that. And I think the fact that we look at it the way we do today is telling about the history of this holiday. So go back to how far back does this go as an idea, this idea of a Labor Day, of a holiday or a celebration?
Okay, well, you're asking a historian to go back. So we could go way back to like medieval Europe and talk about the festivals of the guilds. In a way, that's sort of the background here. But for the United States, this is a really a holiday that begins in the 1880s. So if we put this in perspective here, so this is right in the midst of the major wave of industrialization, of sort of the second industrial revolution. All of the major railroad companies, steel companies, mining companies, all of the sort of infrastructure of industrial America is being created at this time. It was a time of incredible social dislocation, especially for working people. And it's in the context of that Labor Day starts to emerge as a sort of coordinated attempt to create a workers' holiday that can bring workers together across lots of divisions, because American workers were very diverse then as now. Lots of different crafts, lots of different trades, lots of different ethnicities, lots of different languages, different religions. And Labor Day was sort of an opportunity for all workers to come together and to kind of publicly proclaim that they were important, that they deserved the respect of society, and that society itself was going to have to essentially grant workers the public square for this time. So the very first celebration is in New York in 1882, which drew tens of thousands of workers marching down the street and hundreds of thousands of people watching the parade. Parades and pageantry was a major part of these early Labor Days. From New York in 1882, other cities started to adopt their own local Labor Day traditions, which were all a little bit different depending on the location and kind of the ethnic makeup or the labor makeup of whatever town or city it was in, until finally in 1894, it becomes a federal holiday.
I want to go back to what their lives were like right now. You mentioned social dislocation. Tell me what you mean by that phrase.
Okay, so the first thing I think that is very, very different from the way we experience Labor Day to the way they would have experienced Labor Day is the simple fact of workers not going to work and being parading down a public square was a fairly radical act, because these were people who were it was not unusual for people to work 6 or even 7 days a week, often 10 to 12 to sometimes 14 hours a day. An average working week could easily be 70 to 80 hours a week. Much of the sort of the early labor political struggles were about limiting the hours of work. And it was very hard to do so. And I mean, there's a famous Supreme Court case from 1905 where the state of New York had tried to limit the hours of bakers to 60 hours a week. And that was deemed unconstitutional because it limited the number of hours that they could work. So we're used to an eight-hour workday, a five-day work week. We have a lot more free time. That's a direct consequence of the labor movement, carving that time out. So the first thing that workers at the time would have realized is it was a very potent political act to not go to work at a time when they're working 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and to take that time to claim public space and to hold a parade and to march down the public square and to basically say to the rest of society, to politicians, to small business owners, you need to listen to us.
Yeah. Are these largely people without, you know, political influence otherwise, without education? Like, what, you know, who are the people who are doing the kind of trade work and the,
right,
are they immigrants? Are they, you know, you mentioned the diversity of the...
Yeah, it's a very diverse group. The people who are really organizing Labor Day are trade union leaders. Most of them are probably English speaking. A lot of them are probably American born. Some of them would have immigrated from England or English speaking countries. But in cities like New York, and especially like Chicago, where there are huge German immigrant populations, huge populations of people from, at the time it was called Bohemia, this would be like Central Europe. Increasingly late in the 19th century, lots and lots of immigrant Jews from Russia or Italians or Greeks, and a mixture not just of different kinds of Protestants, but Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. So really depending on where you are in the country, the makeup of who's doing the work is different, but it goes, it's all the way from really skilled craftspeople who are in the building trades, who are English speaking, whose families have been in the US for a long time, to new arrivals who maybe don't speak English or speak English as a second or third language and are working in coal mines or meat processing plants or places like that.
So how much does religion or the church, I'm thinking about how they would have communicated, mm-hmm, and how you would have gotten the word out to stand in unity. Is the church, mm-hmm, part of that? Is the newspaper part of that? Is it the union itself?
It's the union itself that's mostly, okay, doing that. It's if you were in a union, at least up and through about the 1920s, the message came down from union leadership, you're going to march in the parade. Actually, unions would fine members that didn't march in, that you could lose a day's work from, mm-hmm, being docked by the union if you weren't out marching in the parade, because the union understood it was really important. It was really the only time of the year that they had to both proclaim to the rest of the public, we are respectable American citizens, and also to send a message to politicians like, there's a lot of us and we can vote. So you need to pay attention to us. So it was really important for the unions to do that. Churches were not totally uninvolved. Beginning in the early 20th century, first Protestant churches and then Catholic churches began the tradition of what was called Labor Sunday, where ministers would basically block that first Sunday of September out and give some sort of sermon on the dignity of work, or how do we treat our fellow man, or these types of things. And there was for a time a pretty close collaboration between some Protestant churches and the labor union in the early 20th century to have a kind of a combination of a political rally / religious revival in some places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is part protest and political statement and part celebration, right? Because
right,
it's also a day off work and there's gotta, right, be food, there's gotta be music, right? Am I imagining this?
No, that's exactly, mm-hmm, right. And it couldn't be too confrontational. That was the other thing, right? They don't wanna scare people. They don't want to send the message that they're a bunch of starry-eyed radicals that want to burn the system down. They want to take a tradition of protest, but make it very American, make it very patriotic, and essentially enlist the support of the broader community and the support of the politicians. They know they don't really have the support, at least initially, of the employing class, which is why we really should think of the first Labor Day parades as basically strikes, because they had no legal authority to just not show up to work and go have a parade. But because there were so many of them out in the streets, they were essentially allowed to do that. And gradually this gets worked into first municipal charters and then state conventions, and then eventually becomes federal law.
How does it become federal law? Because you mentioned the political, I mean, and people wanting that vote. Mm-hmm. Is that tied into how it ends up being a federal law? Is there a handshaking here?
It was an easy bit of symbolism for politicians to agree to Labor Day. That's kind of the least of what working people want. What they were really wanted was the 8-hour workday or a 40-hour work week, which they don't get until the New Deal in the 1930s. They wanted safety laws. They wanted an end to the practice of courts issuing injunctions against strikes, which happens hundreds and hundreds of times in the late 19th, early 20th century. So there were some big ticket items that organized labor really wants that they are not getting or don't get for decades down the road. Labor Day is kind of a nice symbolic way of recognizing the importance of labor, maybe making some sort of political alliance, thinking that you can secure some votes here and there if you're a politician, without kind of giving them the big ticket items that they probably most want.
How has it evolved over, I mean, as I said before, it seems like now it is a time for its day off. It's right. Maybe right around school starting. We think of it as the end of summer. We think of it as a day that retail organizations and car dealerships try to, right. Invite you to go shopping.
Yes.
What changed?
Well, there are a couple of things that we can point. I think you're absolutely right that it has gone from an explicitly worker-centric, and not just worker-centric, really a pretty explicitly labor union-centric holiday, to a holiday that is, I mean, it's not only generic, but it often sort of loses any association with labor at all. It's more about consumption than it is about work. And this all starts to happen in the wake of World War II. Part of that is because there's a much larger middle class with more disposable income. Part of it is because, the labor movement almost succeeds too well. They keep asking for a shorter workday and more time off and more leisure time. Well, if you have more leisure time and you have more disposable income, all of which has come about from the labor movement, then you start thinking about going to, the sale at Sears rather than going to the parade. So that's a part of it. Another part of it is simply that organized labor has had very hard times in the U.S. for nearly four decades now. In the mid-1950s, basically 35% of all privately employed workers were in a union. Today, that's 6%. So without organized labor as being kind of the unifier, without any other sort of social organization stepping up to kind of bring home the notion that this is about celebrating work, hard work, honest work, and really sort of the rights and interests of working people, I think people have come to see it more as an opportunity for recreation than a reflection of sort of the original purpose.
2020 is a year when we started talking about the essential worker in ways that we hadn't perhaps done before. And I think it really began with nurses and doctors and healthcare workers, people who clean, the emergency room, paramedics, first responders. And then it moved into very quickly grocery store, employees and drivers of food and who's gonna get your toilet paper to the grocery store and onto the shelves. Have we been talking about labor and essential work in new ways? It's because for some people, it seems to me that it was the first time that they had noticed there were grocery store, or food right. service workers at the same time when so many people were out of work. What happened right. in 2020 that you think is relevant to this historic conversation?
Well, again, as a historian, I'm more comfortable talking about the past than saying this is what's going to happen. But it does seem to me that, as I was talking about with that shift after World War II, I think we tend to be more comfortable thinking of ourselves and talking of ourselves as consumers than as producers. And what has started to happen in 2020 is it has really sort of exposed how the thing that actually undergirds our society is work that people do. And a sense that maybe we've let it slide a little too long of not recognizing or valuing the importance of that work that other people do. And also at the same time, our ability to be consumers has been somewhat narrowed. It's been somewhat limited. Like I think we're sort of recognizing the limitations of what it means to define ourselves as a society of consumers as opposed to a society of workers. And that is a shift that has played out well over the course of the 20th century. And we may be readjusting that.
I want to go back and ask you something that I wish I had asked a little sooner, which is about the role of gender in those early Labor Day. Yeah. Was it mixed? Were there a lot of women workers that were part of these early trade unions in different trades? Or was this a largely male effort?
There were some women involved. There were not a lot of women involved. It was very gendered. It was very gendered towards men. This was very much like, I mean, a sign of masculinity was that you are an autonomous, independent worker that provides for your family. And in fact, really the mark of a true man by the standards of the time is that your wife doesn't work. So this is very much tied to a sense of manliness and independence, that an independent man should be able to provide for himself and should have a wage that allows for the finer things of life so that his wife or daughters don't have to work. It's also true, there are some examples, for instance, of Southern California in the 1930s and 40s of Labor Day parades that start to use Hollywood actresses, starlets, essentially, almost as models in the parades. Which today we look back and I'm like, on the one hand, they're kind of playing into the celebrity culture of the time and they're kind of tapping in pop culture and fusing that with labor. On the other hand, it is striking that like the first time you see lots of women in these parades, they're there to be ogled at, essentially. that is definitely a legacy that in 2020 would have to be rethought.
Yeah, they're there for the gaze at that point.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. What are some of the untold stories that you know from this era and sort of this battle of workers' rights or even, you know, being acknowledged that mm-hmm. you find fascinating, whether it's a person or mm-hmm. a strike or, you know, something that you think is significant that draws your attention as a historian?
Well, I guess I'm going to take this a little bit different direction. I mean, one of the things that I find really fascinating about Labor Day when we think about it is that it's such an unusual federal holiday. It's a federal holiday that honors a particular group of people in a particular activity. Like we have holidays for veterans, and that makes total sense, right? Because veterans serve the nation, and this is a national holiday. We have holidays honoring the 4th of July. We have holidays honoring presidents. These are national holidays. Almost the only other holiday that is like Labor Day is maybe Martin Luther King Day, where it honors like a social group or a social movement or something. There's no federal holiday for women's suffrage. There's no suffrage day. There's no federal holiday that marks the end of slavery. There's no federal holiday that celebrates national parks. There's no federal, even election day is not a federal holiday. So I think it should remind us of how important the history of labor and the history of working people have been to the country, that with all of the things that we don't mark as national holidays, we do mark work, we do mark labor. Maybe that means that we have to go back and rethink and add a few holidays that we're missing, but it also means that I think we're remiss if we're not reminded what it is we're actually honoring and how unusual it is that a social group and a social movement is seen as so integral to the nation itself.
In 1890, manufacturing workers still found themselves in the factory 60 hours a week. These long days caused many union organizers to push for an 8-hour workday and reducing the work week to just 6 days. Founding father and Mount Rushmore icon Theodore Roosevelt became president around this time of great division between laborers, farmers, globalists, and capitalists in the U.S. Although Roosevelt saw that big business was a valuable part of growing America into the economic powerhouse it was becoming, he also believed workers should be given a square deal. He and many other politicians and business owners saw that for a capitalist economy to function well, there also had to be a healthy number of consumers purchasing the goods being produced. You couldn't simply let them eat cake. workers trying to have their voices heard at the corporate table is still imperative and often frustrating today. Yes, even here in South Dakota. In 2020, President Donald Trump issued an executive order on April 28th calling for operations at America's meat production facilities to continue. Cooper Caraway, the Sioux Falls AFL-CIO president, joined us to help understand the politics of being a designated essential worker, what it was like navigating the issues from the interest of labor during the Smithfield reopening. Cooper, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Lori.
I want to start from the last time that we talked. The plant was closed when you came on the program before, and we were waiting for the report from the CDC from their investigation. We've seen that report now, but we haven't talked about it. Tell me a little bit about some of the limitations of what the CDC investigators were able to tell based on the fact that they did not have access to workers in the plant.
Well, so there's two issues with the CDC report. Number one, obviously, all the recommendations the CDC made, we support, and the workers in general, for the most part, support. You know, it's a 15-page report, and 12, 13 of those pages are all things that Smithfield needs to be doing differently. And we can get behind that. But obviously, the two main issues with the CDC report are that, number one, it's not a particularly enforceable document. The CDC can't enforce it itself. You know, the state government would have to come in and say, hey, we're gonna enforce the document. We're going to make sure that Smithfield abides by every single one of these recommendations. And they haven't done that. And number two, the CDC document makes it very clear that it's an incomplete document. It's an incomplete document because Smithfield upper management did not cooperate fully with the CDC investigation. They did not provide the CDC with significant data that the CDC requested, particularly demographic data and production model data. They're two pieces of data that are very important in order to come up with good recommendations. The CDC has said that they would take the data, they would still accept the data even today if Smithfield wanted to send it over, and then they would update their recommendations. So those are two things that really need to happen. Someone needs to step in and say that they're going to be in charge of enforcing the CDC recommendations, and Smithfield needs to commit to cooperating fully with the CDC.
Farmers need something to do with this, you know, with their hogs, which need to go to market, need to go to slaughter, and workers need to be safe. Is there a way for all those things to happen, for all those needs to be met, or are we really balancing people's health and safety against the food security of a supply chain?
There's certainly a way where everyone's needs can be met, but that requires foresight. And that requires proper planning. So it requires proper planning from the CEOs. Folks at the top of management need to, if you're running any company, honestly, but if you're running a very large and important company, what you need to be doing is having a plan or preparations in place for a situation in which you might need to shut a plant down for a week or 2 weeks. And it's become very clear that none of these large food processors, none of these large food production companies have had any plan for, you know, if they had to shut their plants down for a week or 2 weeks, because they were in complete panic mode when this stuff happens. With prior planning, you can develop ways to where you can maintain supply and productivity and be able to shut down for 2 weeks if your workers need it in order to secure their safety. On the other hand, you need it requires proper planning and foresight from the government to look at and say, okay, if there's an emergency and some food production plants shut down, we need alternatives for these farmers to be able to bring their stock somewhere, whether that's the state and federal government teaming up to buy the hogs from the farmers and give them out to food and handle the processing themselves, give them out to food banks, whatever there is, or if there's a need to kind of break up these large production facilities so that everyone in an area or in a geographic area is not relying on one plant. But if you have many several different plants, some maybe smaller plants, maybe that would be more effective. But, you know, it requires bold leadership and foresight both from the business perspective and the government perspective. And when this pandemic hit, at least, it's very clear we didn't have either one of those.
The issue of long work days, income equality, and labor versus capital is a surging issue today, not only for manufacturing workers, but knowledge workers as well. Now more than ever, as a result of the pandemic, many of us are constantly connected to work. Our office may be at home, our kids crawl onto our laps during meetings, our dogs howl at our feet, maybe our work emails ping to our phones throughout the night. For many, the line between a work life and home life that was always a blurry one is now only a blur of a memory. During the initial shift to working at home, many South Dakota companies struggled with the decision to allow employees to work remotely. Others were ready for action before coronavirus had a major impact on their community. John T. Meyer is the owner and CEO of Lemonly in Sioux Falls. John T., welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Lori. Happy to be here.
Talk a little bit about, as people navigate and learn how to work remotely, we're also taking time to realize that some of these things are things that could be innovations that we implement for better best practices in an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I already saw the cartoon, right, that a guy stood in his computer and he said, oh my gosh, I realized that all those meetings could have actually been emailed. And so I think some people have said this is going to be sort of remote work is going to have its moment right now, some out of necessity.
Yeah,
it's going to go great for some companies and they're going to realize this is something we can do. It's not a scary thing. I actually trust my employees. And it's going to be really hard for others. You know, some companies just weren't prepared or ready. And so I feel for those organizations, and it's going to be, you know, the remote experience might be very challenging. I think what I usually say, and when, you know, and our world has changed in about a week or two, what I normally tell the companies is just try it. I always say use the E word, which is an experiment. And so whether you say, let's just try one day a week, or let's try the first Thursday of every month, you know, and let employees try it on for size and feel it out, you know, and then what I say to employees then is, go home and, you know, work your butt off, right? Like, be very productive, very organized, be effective, and show your team, your boss, your manager that you can do it. Now, I realize all things have changed, right? Schools are closed, kids are at home, and companies are being thrusted into this, whether they like it or not. And I think that's the hard part. So a few best practices. I always suggest you really need to over-communicate, whether you're using phone calls, conference calls, Slack, whatever it is, you need to be over-communicate. And that's really where it keeps the trust going. It keeps the communication lines open. So, hey, I'm jumping offline to, you know, serve. Even I have my four-year-old here. So
perfect.
She's on the call with me right now.
A great example. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Tell them what you're going. Tell your team what you're doing. And then if you're busy, what? And I'm going to go to work. Thanks, Margo. Sorry about that. Yeah, this is real, right?
I know it's real.
Everyone's going through it. And yeah. Honestly, that's the part that's probably, I know how to work from home. Art Lemonly knows how to work from home, but doubling as an employee and as a school teacher has been challenging.
When the Industrial Revolution swept across the countryside, it brought with it disruptive technology. As machinery replaced manual labor, people found themselves out of work. This led to protests across the country. Some of that anger manifested in violence. The Battle of Blair Mountain in Logan County, West Virginia, was the largest organized armed uprising in American labor history since the Civil War, and it had a major impact on labor legislation. Today, rapidly advancing technologies are also a major benefit and major concern to workers. PBS Frontline recently did a special in the age of AI, which highlighted the similarities between that industrial revolution and the one we're living in today, often called the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Thank you for joining us, Neil. We appreciate your time.
Lori, my pleasure.
The people who are driving this have a different idea of how work is done. Tell us a little bit about driverless technology and this Alex Rodriguez, who is really a very young person who is putting the first trucks without drivers on the road and redefining how he wants to go to work every day.
Well, I think he's emblematic of what's happening. I think we'll know we're in the new age of AI. And I think for viewers or listeners who don't really follow this much, I think the important thing is we probably are right on the cusp of a new industrial revolution. And the emblem of that will be the self-driving vehicle. Alex Rodriguez, when I met him, was a 22-year-old dropout of the University of Waterloo in Canada. He took a summer off to build a self-driving golf cart, and did so, and with that got to Silicon Valley and got venture capital, and now has a company called Embark, which is running freight from LA to Arizona to Phoenix on Interstate 10 with a driver in the cab but not driving, and they've been doing that now for some time. He himself won the World Robotics Championships, I think, twice at least, if not three times, age 13, 11, I think. So smart kid, typical of the smart young people who are driving this and who are iconoclastic. Like, they see there's no reason you need drivers. I mean, they take the view. There's also a person in China we interviewed who has his own company. They take the view that the computer will do this much better eventually.
Right.
The one in China told me, if we have 1 million cars with our algorithms driving around Beijing in a few years, and they do it for 1 year, we will have 1 million years worth of driving experience in the program to learn from. The program is learning all the time. Nobody on the planet today has driven for 1 million years. So, you know, they have a whole new outlook in the world, a whole new view, and a whole new optimism about how this can work.
Yeah, and he talks about getting to zero highway deaths. Now, I'm not sure that he's as motivated. You got to talk to him in person, but I'm not sure if the zero highway death motivates him as much as the potential for growth for his company. But he is pointing that out, where this is the goal, to get where where we can avoid the tragedy of people dying on the highway. And then there is the application, and we get to meet a truck driver who is sort of looking at this from a different perspective of what it means for jobs here in America. What happens to the trucking industry? And we have many truck drivers who listen to South Dakota Public Radio. What happens to them?
Well, I think the trucking industry is in for great change. It's been suffering through great change since the 80s, when it was deregulated. Truck driver's earnings have gone in real terms from $100,000 to $40,000 a year. And that's because of intense competition. And the hauling agents and companies have been pushing down wages throughout. Technology helps with that, because if you have technology that keeps people in their lane, it vibrates the seat if you leave your lane, it warns you if you're too close to a vehicle, it gives you backup cameras and GPS. You can have younger drivers, less experienced drivers driving the vehicles, and consequently, drivers who earn less money. And that's been the pressure on truck drivers now for a long time. And what's going on, and that will now be accelerated. It looks pretty certain. I mean, Alex Rodriguez said the big sales pitch he has to the company is he can cut their costs in half. Now, it's going to be hard to stop that sort of technology if it becomes successful. It will only be allowed if it's safe, obviously, but it's going to be hard to stop it if it can cut your salary, your costs in half. I think it will begin, in terms of trucks, it will begin with the way Embark are doing it, which is exit to exit. So a driver drives the vehicle to the highway exit, and then the computer will take over. And that way you could have several trucks following each other on the highway to the appointed exit where they're going to deliver it. Then another driver will take over. And there could be advantages in that for truck drivers. They may have more local work and less haulage, long haulage work. But there will be jobs lost. I think there's no question of that. There will be jobs lost eventually. And that's the emblematic issue, the AI. I mean, the truck really throws all that into stark relief. There are great benefits. Road deaths, the carnage on the roads could be much reduced. Truck drivers could be home at night, and costs can come down. But there'll be people put out of work. And there may be people put out of work who don't have the skill set to pick up any new jobs that are coming along because they're going to demand much more technical knowledge.
Right.
And I don't, think that is exactly the dilemma we face.
Yeah, and don't have the resources because of the way the salaries are dropping to invest in some kind of training or new education to go on to the next thing. How many jobs are vulnerable to artificial intelligence replacement? That number was staggering to me.
Some of the best estimates put it at 50% essentially of jobs, because it's not just going to be truck drivers. The thing about AI, once you give it the rules of a specific domain, so say, for example, accountancy, the machine will do that better than the accountant once it knows the rules, and it will learn every time it does it. And it will work 24/7, 365 days a year, and it won't have a hangover after the Super Bowl. So the prospects of that, that could go into every field. It can go into lawyers, where a lot of young lawyers spend their days going over great tomes and looking for precedents of the legal cases. The computer will do that. We have computers, programs now that read doctor's notes. Radiologists may be the same. So there are all these fields where there's going to be great disruption in the next 5 to 10 years or so is the best estimate. And I don't think we're quite ready for that. I don't think we've taken that on board, and I don't think the politicians have taken it on board.
The Great Railroad Strike of 1877 is considered the bloodiest labor management confrontation in U.S. history. The uprising was in response to the railroad executives' decision to cut wages and lay off employees. If we think the current industrial revolution will simply be a smooth transition, we're likely to be mistaken and unprepared. Because these types of transformations are in no way the fault of workers, some argue the public sector should have programs in place to help in times of extreme job displacement. One of those that operated in South Dakota was the Civilian Conservation Corps. It was a voluntary public work relief program that ran from 1933 to 1942 in America for unemployed, unmarried men.
On March 27, 1933, 23 days after he was inaugurated into his first term as U.S. President, Franklin Roosevelt presented Congress with a plan meant to ease the pain of the Great Depression. It was called the Emergency Conservation Work Act. Roosevelt promised work for a quarter of a million unemployed. 4 days later, Congress passed the bill on a voice vote. A week later, Roosevelt issued an executive order establishing the Civilian Conservation Corps, or CCC. Hundreds of thousands of unmarried men between the ages of 17 and 25 enrolled. Enrollees committed to at least 1 6-month work period and no more than 2 years. By July of 1933, 317,000 men were employed by the CCC all over the United States. They labored in America's fields and forests and lived together in army-style camps close to where they worked. By the time the program ended in 1942, more than 30,000 men had been put to work in South Dakota. They were known as the CCC Boys. Jay Hendrickson, a native South Dakotan born in Huron and growing up in the town of Mystic in the center of the Black Hills, was one of them.
Great experience. It was a great experience. And it helped me throughout my whole life. I'm 97 and a half right now. And I was 16 years old when I joined the CC. You were supposed to be 18, but I kind of fudged on that a little bit because I wanted to do something and I didn't have any job and couldn't go to school. So I joined the CC. First, I worked on the road we built. They built a lot of roads in the hills, and this road was over by Deerfield, Ditch Creek Road. And I worked that one, the first summer, and then that winter I drove truck. I drove truck and I hauled rock to when they built Silver Lake Hotel. I hauled a lot of rock that they built the hotel out of.
Henriksen did his fair share of work with a pick and shovel.
Yeah, and I run a jackhammer for a long time there where they blasted rock, you know, and drilled holes for the powder to put in.
CCC projects are visible all over the Black Hills. Otto Bachman is the director of the CCC Museum in Hill City.
In my opinion, and I think most people would agree, that the Black Hills would certainly not be what they are without these guys. All of the lakes in the Black Hills, with the exception of Sylvan Lake and Pactola, were either started or completed by these guys. It's just amazing. The infrastructure at Custer State Park, the Norbeck Building, which was initially the visitor center until they built their new building last year or 2 years ago. Beautiful old rock structures, been well maintained. The site of Black Hills Playhouse was Camp Lodge, and there still remains one building there that is original. They've done some work on it.
Lydia Austin is the interpretive programs manager at Custer State Park. Signs of the CCC's work are everywhere in the park.
This park wouldn't be the park it is without the CCC. They just did a ton here in the park and just kind of got us ready to go for that next era of being a world-class state park here.
I truthfully think, my own opinion, of course, those 9 years that the CCs were in existence, that more was done for conservation than was done before, or in that fact, have done since.
Former CCC worker Jay Henriksen also remembers that life in the Civilian Conservation Corps was a lot like being in the Army.
And each camp was set up for 200 men, 200 boys, they called them then, but they weren't actually men. And each camp had a commanding officer. They also had a medical officer in each camp. They had a supply sergeant. Yeah, they didn't take any crap from you, you know. You had to be there, and you had to get up in the morning, and you stood something like reveille, where you was counted, and then you had mess call, and you also had sick call, just like the Army.
But life as a CCC boy wasn't all work.
We did party whenever we could, and there was local dances here in Hill City and around the area, and Saturday we generally had one of those dances if we could possibly get to town, you know. And they did provide transportation for you to go to town. They had baseball, and they had basketball, and they had all kinds of different things for you to do. They liked recreation. Whoever figured that out really took care of those kids when they were in there.
The CCC also provided educational opportunities.
Each camp had an educational advisor in the camp, and they taught all kinds of, well, regular school. And they also taught like typing, and they taught auto mechanics. They taught welding and several others, whatever. If you had a group of kids and they wanted to learn something, they'd go to this educational advisor and he'd set up a class for them. They were that good about it.
Like a lot of CCC boys, Jay Henriksen enlisted in the Army during World War II.
Some camps enlisted in the Army en masse. I always figured Roosevelt had something in the back of his mind. He saw all these things happening in the world, and when it was all over in 42, when the Congress wouldn't appropriate any more money to operate the CCs. He had 3 million young men all set for to go in the Army.
Hendrickson was called up again during the Korean War. When the wars were over, he went into the grain and feed business. He built elevators and feed mills and ended up owning his own company. He was active in the Lions Club for many years and helped establish the South Dakota CCC Museum in Hill City.
Me and a couple other people, or three or four other people, we used to have meetings every year, kind of a get-together, you know, and we talked about it. And finally, one time we decided at one meeting we'll just do it.
The CCC Museum is just east of Hill City on Highway 385. Otto Bachman is the manager.
First of all, we have a nice display of tools that were actually used during that period of time, but we have a lot of photographs, a lot of material that we've digitized so that folks can see copies of original documents. And so there's quite a lot of information. We have an ongoing project of names of young men that were in the CCC. We have about 20,000, give or take, names of the 31,000 or so that served in South Dakota. And we add to that quite often. We have a written roster of those guys, and folks will come in, find a relative, or if they know that their relative was in the CCC, we don't have them on the roster. Oftentimes they'll contact the National Archive, get a copy of discharge papers or enrollment papers, and so that we're able to add those names to our roster.
Jay Hendrickson and Otto Bachman would both like to see the museum in a larger space. Given Hendrickson's record of getting things done and the local community's support of the facility, it's a definite possibility.
Programs like the CCC were not accessible to women, leaving women with a unique set of challenges. The husband loses his job. Who's going to work? Is there work for women that pays enough to support the family? If I work, who will take care of the kids? Sound familiar? If I work, who will take care of the kids? Yes, women worry about that now. Has anyone been more impacted by the current pandemic labor disruption than parents? But consider a time with such rigid gender roles that to expect the man of the house to stay home and raise children was outlandish, laughable. And even though the gender roles have dramatically changed since the late 19th century, today's women and men are still asking, who will take care of the kids if I go to work? Universal preschool has become a labor issue, not just an educational one. In the moment, spent months diving into that issue, and we discovered some great insights. Mary Bowne and Carolyn Kipps joined us to discuss pre-K from a healthcare and education research perspective. Dr. Bowne is a professor at South Dakota State University who specializes in early childhood education and human development. Dr. Kipps is a physician specializing in developmental and behavioral pediatrics. Mary Bowne is professor at South Dakota State University who specializes in early childhood education and human development. Mary, thank you for being here. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And she's joining us from the Janine Basinger Studio at South Dakota State University. And with us here in the Kirby Family Studio, we have Dr. Carolyn Kipps. She's with Sanford Children's and works with developmental and behavioral pediatrics as well. Dr. Kipps, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Mary, I want to start with you and tell me a little bit about your work and your specialty with your expertise and educational background, if you would, please. Let's set the stage.
Absolutely. So I obtained my bachelor's and master's degree from South Dakota State in human development and early childhood, and then my educational doctorate in curriculum and instruction from USD. I've worked many hours observing children in the pre-K setting. We have a laboratory school here at South Dakota State University campus where we have children enrolled who are toddlers all the way through kindergarten. And so there's daily observations that I can make and interactions that I can make with the children and families as well. And then my research stems back to my observations as well as other studies that I've been completing.
And Dr. Kupis, tell us a little bit about your work with Sanford.
So I'm a developmental behavioral pediatrician, and what I usually explain to parents is we're kind of a rare breed of doc. There's not a lot of us around, but what it means is I'm a general pediatrician with extra training in child development and behavior. So in our clinic, we work with kids who have some variation in their developmental process, what language delays, motor delays, or behavioral problems.
All right. So what we're trying to get at this month is we have these ongoing conversations about early learning and preschool and basically little kids and how they think and how they learn. Mary, when we're talking about pre-K education, we're talking about early learning. How do you define that? What are we? Because what we're finding is as people come in, they have different ideas of what this is. We've heard everything from socialization to indoctrination to they had to learn how to stand in line to it's more important to stay home and play. So how do you frame this conversation?
Absolutely. So typically, pre-K is a classroom-based preschool program for children under the age of 5 years. It's usually a program that develops social-emotional skills, academic skills, and exposes children to an educational environment using a play-based curriculum. And that's what's so important is the play. What research has shown time and time again that children need to play. And this type of play isn't with technological devices. It's with human contact and with real materials in hand. We all learn in different ways. Some learn with visuals, some learn by listening. But within a pre-kindergarten classroom, you're going to see all of that taking place, primarily with hands-on activities for these children. And you're going to see structured components to the day, and you're going to see unstructured components. So it's structured being group times and small group activities. Unstructured time is free play, and that free play is their planned activities based on the children's individual goals as well as the classroom needs and individual needs. But within that time period, children are allowed to go do what they want to do within the classroom, and ultimately what that's helping them build is their confidence, self-expression, the creativity, communication, logical thinking, and problem solving, and the list goes on.
And Dr. Kupis, another thing that we keep hearing is that gets into this idea of brain development and child development and socialization in some, from some perspectives, and really about identifying problems. Is it, and some people are saying, well, we really need to identify any kind of developmental delays and problems early so we can address them. And other people saying, yeah, if you identify too early, we put kids into these boxes and labels, and then they're just going to catch up, by third grade. They're going to catch up by first grade. They might just be being four, and they might pick up a label in a pre-K environment that they wouldn't have if they hadn't been there. Help us put that into perspective.
Right, and it's hard because I think families come to us with some of these preconceived notions. I don't want my kid to be labeled. I don't want to, and I guess from sitting on the side of the desk that we do in the clinic, that we want to identify differences that are significant enough that are getting in that child's way, because then we want to implement interventions that will help them narrow that gap, catch up, and do it faster, And could some of these mild delays maybe just, would the kids potentially just catch up on their own, or is there, sure, but what if we catch them up faster and then we get them right on pace with their peers right away, and then we're not waiting around for it to happen? So I think early intervention is shown time and time again to be the best approach to developmental differences for kids.
Today, it seems Labor Day is no longer about trade unionists marching down the street with banners and their tools of the trade slung across sturdy shoulders or clenched in tight fists. Instead, it's a confused holiday, with nothing more than a sale here or there to remind us of why and how we work. Our shared rituals have faded. So, how about this year? If you work all the time, I mean all the time, and you never really get around to that vacation, start a new ritual that honors the original spirit of Labor Day. Give yourself the day off. Give others the day off. Power down your computer, ignore that pinging cell phone, lay down your tools of the trade, if only for one blissful day or one blissful moment, to honor the workers of the past and the work yet to be done. The work will be waiting when you come back. At least this year, we hope it will. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by Josh Heyer. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.